Thank you very much, and good evening once again, everyone. Donald and I are going to talk for about 35, 40 minutes, after which we'll leave plenty of time for questions. Donald, we heard there of your distinguished journalistic career, not least as a political writer for The Independent, but it's your years, obviously, covering the Middle East, especially the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which are our special focus for tonight, for it was they which proved the inspiration for the book which we're here to discuss, Gaza, Preparing for Dawn. Now, you spent a number of years covering the whole region and travelling around. When it came to try to make sense of it, if I can put it that way, in the book, why did you choose to focus on Gaza?
Well, unlike you, I was never actually based there. I was based in Jerusalem, but I made a lot of trips. I guess something nearly 100, probably, in the time I was there. I mean, first of all, I think, particularly after 2006, when Israeli journalists were prevented by the Israeli government from going into Gaza, and it also became harder for foreigners who weren't journalists to go in. It was a kind of, this may sound very soppy, but it was a sort of kind of privilege that we had, in that we were able to go in and, unlike most people in Gaza, out. So I sort of felt that was, you know, that was worth doing something with. But the other reason, I think, was that it was, this was a period in Gaza's very turbulent history, going back many millennia, at least four. It was a pretty momentous period. I mean, in other words, a lot happened. And I suppose, in that awful corny phrase, I had a bit of a ringside seat. So there was the end, or the last year, effectively, of the, in an intense way, of the Second Intifada, which you, of course, covered in James's excellent book, I may say, No Road Home. I sort of picked up where you went off. So you had the last year of the Second Intifada, disengagement, Hamas being elected in 2006, the international reaction to Hamas, of which I'm pretty critical in the book, then the brief but pretty bloody civil war between Fatah and Hamas in June, culminating in June 2007, then basically three Israeli assaults, of which the 2008-9 one, Operation Cast Lead, and the 2014 one, Operation Protective Edge, were the most serious, because both of them involved ground forces and very heavy casualties, and 10 years of blockade. So I sort of thought that this was a kind of period that was worth chronicling, really.
You mentioned there that you were able to come and go, and as you also point out, not many people can do that in Gaza. I'm sure some people in the room have been to Gaza. It used to be easier for people to go than it is now. How did that feel, being surrounded by people? You could come in for a couple of days if you wanted to go and that. How did that feel, and how did that work when you were dealing with contributors, either as a journalist or gathering material for your book, when you were talking to these people, and yet, you know, you enjoyed the freedoms which were,
yes,
literally beyond their dreams?
I think that's a really good point, and I think you do feel kind of guilty about the ease with which you can move in and out. And of course, over the period, I mean, you know, it's worth pointing out that actually restrictions on Palestinian movement out of Gaza, you know, certainly didn't start with Hamas being elected. In fact, they go back really to the early 90s, when it became much more difficult, or much more of a bureaucratic procedure for Palestinians to leave Gaza. But, you know, by the time we're talking about, it was getting more difficult. And of course, now, I just saw some figures from the Israeli human rights agency, Gisha, saying that this year is the worst in terms of movement in and out of Gaza for Palestinians since Operation Protective Edge in 2014. So you're absolutely right. I mean, it is a very big thing, and the biggest prison in the world is a terrible cliche, but it affects almost every aspect of life. I mean, some of the most dramatic ways, of course, are medical, in that people are unable to get to hospitals in the West Bank or Israel frequently. I mean, a very large proportion of applications for permits to do that are turned down. And actually, Mohamed Abbas has now made that worse because he's not, the PA is not paying for the healthcare for so many people. So that's an added problem. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you do. And of course, one of the, I mean, I don't sort of need to tell people who have been to Gaza that, you know, you find you always come with sort of, you know, essential goods of one kind or another, because people, you know, very simple things which people can't get. That's less so now because consumer goods are more available since 2011. But you don't feel great about the fact that you can go out and other people can't.
And when you did go out, when you went back to Jerusalem, where you were living at the time you were corresponding there, how was it to sort of explain to friends and neighbours what it was like? Because one thing that I think, you know, with the increasingly, the decreasing contact between Israelis and Palestinians, I mean, when I was there, for example, I was in my mid-30s, and most people of my age or older had casual jobs in Israel. And that sort of employment has completely disappeared in the last 15 years. So what was it like? Did people ask you what it was like? Because you, as a sort of third national in a way, had access which neither Israelis or Palestinians
had. No, I think that's true. I mean, Israelis tend to ask you. I mean, Gaza has become, even more than it was before, I think, a sort of dark and mysterious place for most Israelis. And so they do tend to say, what's it like? And if you say, well, actually, you know, there are some quite good hotels and restaurants, I mean, that is not the full story of Gaza, I hasten to say. They look at you completely gobsmacked. So I think that's true. But I also think now that the closure is so severe that, you know, even Palestinians in the West Bank feel, you know, very cut off from Palestinians in Gaza. Of course, they may have relatives. I mean, lots of Palestinians in the West Bank have relatives in Gaza and vice versa. But I remember a very elegant woman who ran a beautician's, a part of the great Kishta family, saying to me several years ago that she found that when, on the rare occasions that she was able to go to a conference in the West Bank, you know, I mean, at that time it was easier to get into Egypt than in the West Bank. West Bank Palestinians would come up to her and they were sort of amazed that she was kind of incredibly well dressed and, you know, very elegant, spoke, you know, very, very high class Arabic. And they said, aren't you all living in, you know, Coric tents kind of thing? I mean, practically. Yeah. She was very sort of, you know, she was pretty heard about that. So yeah, I think it's a kind of, even to some Palestinians, it's a foreign country. I think that's true.
You mentioned the sort of going back four millennia when you're thinking about it. I mean, one of the challenges which people have in understanding the complexities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the weight of history. I mean, how did you decide where you were going to start?
Well, I mean, really, I sort of cheated, and actually, as I said earlier, I think there's a bit of overlap, but in time, I kind of really started where you left off, that's to say, in the period, I mean, making it easy for myself, that I was going to Gaza a lot, which really started in 2000, I went the first time in 2003, but then much more in 2004 when I was actually based in Jerusalem. But you can't really do that. I mean, it's a sort of attempt to make it a kind of type of contemporary history, but you can't really just start there. So I've got this rather breathless kind of run through the history. I don't attempt to go back to the time of the pharaohs, but I do sort of try and take people through from 1917, when the British finally took Gaza on their way to Jerusalem, up until Oslo, just because I don't really think that you can, you know, and I suppose that's directed at probably not people in this room, but readers who really don't know anything about the history. So, of course, the history of that. I mean, you know, just, you know, the population much more than doubled in 1948, and because of refugees, and, you know, now out of the nearly 2 million people in Gaza, something like 1.2, 1.3 are refugees. So, you know, you can't really sort of pretend that didn't happen. I mean, it's had an enormous effect on Gaza. And, of course, what had been the old mandatory Gaza district under the British mandate was shrunk into this thing that we now call the Gaza Strip, which also had a devastating effect on native Gazans, as it were. I mean, not just on refugees.
You offer in the book, you offer your reader analysis of policy, of diplomacy, of politics, but also a lot of personal stories. You know, the donkey market, I think, gets in there. Some of you may know that expensive things in the Palestinian territories are priced in Jordanian dinars, at least they were when I was there, property and livestock, whereas the shekel, the Israeli shekels used in day-to-day transactions, I was always struck by that, that big things were priced in Jordanian dinars.
That's right.
And so, but how did you decide to offer this sort of analysis of the US and EU policy to Hamas afterwards and the ill-advisedness or otherwise of it, along with those sort of stories? How did you manage to weave the two together? Because obviously both needed very much to tell a story.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, it is a bit of a hybrid in that sense. I mean, I did want to tell the story through the ordinary people of so-called ordinary people. I mean, I think it's a terrible term anywhere, and it's a particularly terrible term in the extraordinary circumstances of Gaza, where there really are no ordinary people for that very reason. But I think, it was impossible to do that, really, without the political context. And as I was suggesting earlier, I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was to slightly puncture the myth that is very deeply embedded in the Israeli psyche now, that, you know, disengagement under Sharon, the Israelis left Gaza, and we gave them a terrific chance to prosper and have a peaceful, lovely life there by the sea, and all we got was rockets. And I try, in the sort of post-disengagement chapter in my book, to show that it was, to put it mildly, a great deal more complicated than that. So once you start on that, you can't really completely let it go. And so you're right, there are these two rather sort of disparate trends in the book. And one of them is the role of the international community, which I think has been pretty seriously deficient. And I think it was, you know, I'm certainly not Hamsawi, as the Gazans would say, of people who support Hamas at all. And indeed, I'm very critical of it in the book. But I think it was a dreadful error of the international, the so-called quartet, to impose really unfulfillable conditions on Hamas immediately after the election. So, you know, these things affect, the blockade affects people's live, so it's really impossible to separate the two. And I mean, one of the noticeable things about Palestinians, and not just in Gaza, I think, but also in the West Bank, is that they follow and are knowledgeable about politics to a very, you know, very extreme extent. It's fantastically easy, for example, to talk to Palestinians about elections or politics in a way that I know from personal experience it isn't in the UK. And of course the reason you try and find Worcester woman in Worcester, and of course there's a very obvious reason for that, which is that, you know, politics affects the day-to-day lives of Palestinians. So if you're trying to say something about the day-to-day lives, you can't really avoid the politics.
Now, you did hint at this a little bit earlier, Donald, but you've given us this sort of time frame of when you've been regularly visiting there and when you were living there. So it's been a time of tremendous change, because when you arrived there, there were still Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip. You mentioned the conflicts as well. What do you think, though, and you've seen a lot of the conflicts, you've seen a lot of change, what sort of milestones really stand out amongst that? Gosh. Describe?
Well, I mean, disengagement itself was obviously a very, very big moment. I mean, and actually within Gaza, it did make, there's no point in dancing around, it made a very positive difference.
This was when the Israelis withdrew the settlements.
This is when the Israelis withdrew the settlements. Sharon's government withdrew in the summer of 2005. And, you know, you would remember, at least as well as anybody else in this room, the Abu Huli checkpoint, which was, you know, cut off Gaza between Gaza City and Khan Yunis, and was a sort of dreadful place. It was dangerous. There were queues would build up. It was a really fearsome place, and it made travel from the north to the south of Gaza pretty well impossible. Plus, people who lived in Khan Yunis could not get to the sea because there was this great chunk of Jewish settlements, which was Gush Katif. So in that sense, it made a very big difference. But what I try and argue in the book is that the difference was, though positive in that sense, actually in many ways negative in others, because it was part, really, of a further separation of the Gaza Strip from both Israel and the West Bank. So you had those, one of the examples I use in the book is the Erez Industrial Zone, which had been a very important meeting place, actually, between commercial meeting place between Palestinians and Israelis up to then, which Olmert closed before disengagement. So, and the other thing was, I think, that the economic progress, which James Wolfensohn, actually, who I think to his credit, really did try and make something of the nurseries which the settlers had left behind, those that they hadn't actually destroyed. And, you know, the harvest in November 2005 did not get out. And it did not get out because the Karni cargo crossing was closed most of the time. Now, this sounds incredibly nerdy detail, but it meant, actually, that the immediate post-disengagement period was, in economic terms, very bad. And, of course, in a sense, that paved the way for the much greater blockade that started to kick in after Hamas won the elections. But you say, what changes? Well, I mean, you know, the blockade was a huge change in the sense that, you know, nobody pretends that Gaza was in sort of economically great shape before 2006, 2007. But, you know, there were still hundreds, to take one single sector, hundreds of clothing factories, mainly, you know, making, I mean, I follow one very closely in the book, and this is a guy who was making jeans for the teenage Tel Aviv fashion market. Mm. Now, there were hundreds of factories of varying size like that, and they virtually all closed. Some of them came back with, you know, trickling into the, after 2011, managing to sort of make a few goods for the local market. But, you know, Gaza was, even during the Intifada, I mean, even in your period there, Gaza was still exporting a lot, yeah. And exports stopped. So, I mean, the economic implosion is a very big change, and, of course, the wars are a very big change.
Yeah. You mentioned that, you know, your Israeli friends and neighbours, when you were back in Jerusalem, would sort of ask you what it was like there, and even some West Bank Palestinians had this sort of picture of a sort of a hellhole, really. But I mean, it's not obviously without hazard going there. And did you ever feel unsafe there? You write in the book about Alan Johnston, whom you knew, who of course was kidnapped and held for 16 weeks before being released. Were you ever worried about that?
Well, I think the first thing to say, which maybe is a slightly oblique answer, is that, you know, quite honestly, if you walk now in Gaza, you know, in what every Palestinian calls Gaza, but foreigners tend to call Gaza City, at night, I mean, I feel a lot safer than I do in Hackney, say. because actually, it feels very unthreatening in a sort of city street sense. Now, that period you're talking about was not quite so sort of secure because, Alan was the last of and the most serious, actually, of a series of pretty brief kidnap yeah. cases. And there was a period when journalists didn't go much in. I mean, immediately after he was kidnapped, they did. But, of course, I mean, again, I'm sounding like an apologist for Hamas, which I really, really am not. But, you know, the fact was that that in terms of the sort of internecine warfare, clan warfare, and, you know, very extreme groups like the Jaish al-Islam, which kidnapped Alan, Hamas is, as it were, rescue of Alan Johnson, or at least the final surrender by the Dogmush family of Alan Johnston to Hamas, was a major moment in Hamas exercising, you know, of sort of controlling it. I think that the... So in that sense, it was, you know, it felt a lot safer, and Hamas did. I mean, in a way, you could argue that was Hamas's one political card was the law and order card, which they did succeed in bringing. Otherwise, I think, I haven't felt since then in danger of being kidnapped, really. So, you know, insofar as there is danger, which for foreigners like us is not usually that great. It's, you know, when there are engagements going on with Israelis, and then it doesn't feel madly safe. No.
You mentioned that fewer journalists go there at certain times, and certainly there are fewer of them going these days. And in fact, the columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Anshel Pfeffer, recently suggested that. He predicted, in fact, having looked at how little 1967 and the half century of the occupation was really marked internationally, he predicted that this year, which we'll see 70 years of al-Nakba and the founding of the State of Israel, that he's saying the world's sort of forgotten about us. And obviously one can see from an editorial point of view, there are a lot of other conflicts in the region, budgets are tighter than ever in many cases. From a diplomatic point of view, this conflict has defied solution, and one diplomat I spoke to said it was like the Rubik's Cube. People would keep trying because it is this sort of problem. But, I mean, how do you feel when you see that it is reported far less than once it was?
Well, when I was in Gaza for about 10 days in December, and when I came out, I happened to bump into a businessman who features quite a lot in my book, actually, Jordath Al-Hudri. And... he said, "How's the book going? How's it selling?" He said, and I thought, "Oh God, typical businessman's question." And then I realised, he explained why he was asking, because he said, for me, this is a sign of whether anybody cares about Gaza in the world. I mean, he wasn't so worried about my book sales. He was, and I think you're right. I mean, I think the very odd and rather depressing thing about Gaza is that during Operation Protective Edge and before that Operation Cast Lead, it was a huge story on it was on everybody's television screens, it was discussed in Parliament, sort of massive thing. And then once it's over, it sort of passes to a very great extent out of the headlines. And of course, what's happening in Yemen at the moment is unspeakably horrendous, also with some, Western backing of the Saudis. And, the situation is, Syria is unimaginably awful. And, of course, I understand that. But I think it is also true, and there may be people who very strongly disagree with this in this room, I think one of the difficulties at the moment is the extent to which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has sort of been overtaken by these other issues. And what used to be actually not necessarily with great success, but was the sort of central issue for Western diplomacy in the Middle East, hardly is at all now. And I just said one other thing about what you said about Anshel Pfeffer's piece. I mean, it's right that people aren't really remembering the 50th anniversary of the occupation on anything like the scale you might have expected, and that may also be true of the 70th anniversary of the Nakba and the creation of the State of Israel. But, you know, one shouldn't ignore the fact that the Israeli right now are, I mean, and this is a shock, actually genuinely a shock to me, having been going back last year quite a lot, having been posted there in 2012, which is this swing away from the slightest embarrassment about the occupation. Mm-hmm. So now you have ministers, and not just people like Naftali Bennett, but also people in Likud, celebrating the what you and I think would call the occupation, celebrating the liberation, as they seem to see it, of the territories that were occupied in 1967. Now, you know, even Sharon spoke about the occupation. I mean, it was, and I think that's a big change in the sort of Israeli polity. Mm. So those were the people that really marked 1967, actually, in Israel. Yeah.
What, I mean, you've observed the conflict at length and in detail. I'm going to put you on the spot a little now and ask you, can it be resolved? And two questions, you know, can it be resolved? And this just and lasting peace that everybody so often expresses to be their desire, is it achievable? And if so, what would it look like?
Well, just a little question. Well, I mean, funnily enough, I think it is achievable in one important sense, which is when the rest of the world wakes up to the extraordinary injustice of several million Palestinians. This, apart from anything else, is, you know, I mean, not that this is particularly relevant, you know, probably the most educated population, Arab population in the region, have been, you know, for half a century without political rights, or for that matter, the civil rights that they were promised in the Balfour Declaration by the British government. And I think for that to happen, I obviously want people to buy my own book, but and yours, but I think Nathan Thrall's book, The Only Language They Understand, made a very important, which was, came out last year, very important point, that, you know, the great myth about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is, if they don't want to sort it out, it won't get sorted out. I mean, this is absolutely the reverse, in my view, is the case. And I think Thrall's book is very persuasive on the need. You know, you're only going to have that happen if particularly the Americans, but to some extent, in my view, the Europeans, who I think could do a lot more than they do, put pressure, and really, I mean pressure on the strongest, by exponentially the strongest party, namely Israel. Mm. And, you know, I think when, you know, at some point, I guess, that may happen. But of course, you know, I mean, in a way, Trump is a, you know, any idea that Trump is about to do this is completely negative. And much as I admire him in many ways, I think on this issue, the Obama presidency, because I think Obama came into office actually getting the Israeli-Palestinian story better than any of his predecessors, and certainly better than his successor. But, you know, in the end, he didn't really exercise the traction he should have done. And I guess his defenders would say that the Iran deal became, you know, the paramount foreign policy objective. But, you know, it's not, it's sort of up to us, actually, whether this thing can be solved. You say, how and what would it look like? I've always, you know, opted out of the kind of one-state, two-state question. I mean, it's very, very difficult.
Can I ask you all the same?
Well, you know, my argument is, it doesn't really matter whether you have one state. My friend Bassem Aramin, from the West Bank, sometimes says he doesn't care. You know, one state, two state, three states, five states. Just we want our rights. Yeah. And in a sense, I think that is, you know, I sometimes feel the one state versus two state argument sort of dances on the head of a pin. But of course, I mean, I'm not suggesting it's not important. Well, if you ask me, if I were an Israeli, which I'm not, but I would be a secular Israeli, I guess, politically on the left, I would, you know, prefer to live in a secular, binational, multinational state. But I also recognise, I mean, I haven't yet figured out how you get there without 100 years of bloodshed, which is the only reason that I've sort of still, I don't cling to this two-state solution, but I sort of don't, it still seems marginally more accessible in the short term. But, you know, things are changing very fast. You know, Israel does not want to get out, I mean, sorry, a dominant, many Israelis do, but a dominant hegemonic element in the Israeli in Israeli politics now do not want to leave the West Bank or to cede their control of Gaza. And as long as that's the case, then frankly, a one-state solution, if you know, becomes much more plausible.
Yeah, I mean, because if you look
at... It's a kind of confused answer.
Yeah, but if you look at... it's one thing, it's a question to which I never got a fully satisfactory answer when I was there, was... How could this possibly work? How would you actually have a state which has got another state in between the two? I mean, there probably are, I suppose, there's Kaliningrad and the rest of Russia, but there aren't many precedents, and particularly when you look at the West Bank and the geography of it, the way that it is expressly divided up, it does seem very hard to see, and very frequent United Nations, European Union reports make this point that there isn't really enough left of the West Bank. Contiguous is the word always used. To make a state there?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there are people, and I think, by the way, for young Palestinians discussing this now, I mean, have increasingly, very understandably, given up on the idea of two states. There are people, the Avishai Margalit's left-wing Israeli think tank, Malad, who sort of very valiantly argue that actually... that the precedent of the removal of settlements from Gaza is repeatable in the West Bank, even though it has to be said that I find it, I mean, you know, the West Bank, some of the West Bank settlers, I mean, some of them are really just dormitories, like Ariel and Mali Adumim, which, you know, are not even, many of the people are not even massively ideological. But, I mean, places like Itamar and Hebron, it's kind of difficult to see those people going without a struggle. What the Malad people say is, and I'm saying this is the argument that you can still keep this two-state thing alive, is all you have to do in the end, if they resist, is switch off the utilities and, you know, just make it, you know, if you want to stay there, you're back in tents. I'm not sure about that, but I just know that there's a very great injustice here, and I don't know, I don't pretend to be an expert on which is the best solution, the most feasible solution at the moment.
I'm sure there's lots of questions from the audience. I just want to ask a couple more, please, Don. I mean, you mentioned Donald Trump, his coming to power in the recent unilateral recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, means he's clearly lost the trust of the Palestinians. Might that open the way for a bigger role for the European Union, do you think?
Well, I personally think it would. I just think that you have to believe, though, that the EU is capable of constructing a coherent foreign policy and then implementing it, which I think the jury is, to put it politely, out on. And there are people in this room who know a lot more about the EU than I do. But yes, I mean, I think the Europeans, in a sense, are the kind of sleeping giants in this conflict. I mean, in Eugene Rogan's phrase, you know, this was a conflict made in Europe. And of course, it was made in Europe. And so, I mean, I think there's a very great historic responsibility for, I mean, the Germans and the British, probably first and foremost, but for other European countries as well. And, you know, the EU relationship with Israel, trading-wise, is a very, very important one. And I think that, you know, if European countries really implemented a serious policy in favour of what they all sign up to, namely the illegality in international law of the settlements, and sort of put their money where their mouth is on that issue, I think it would have a very great effect on even the Netanyahu government. And at the moment, I don't see that happening at anything like the level it could be.
You mentioned that you were in Gaza just late, very late last year, just a few weeks ago, really. And it was around the time when the US had made this this move. Did you sense, as speculated inevitably a bit at the time, that there might be a return to large-scale violence in the region? The last time that there was the major international media attention was in the summer of 2014, precisely because there was large-scale armed conflict with a lot of civilian casualties. Did you get any sense that there's a prospect of a return to that, as
I think
people were speculating?
Well, I think it's really hard to judge. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, what's interesting, actually, is the extent to which the Israeli military, but some figures in the military have been sort of warning publicly that the kind of humanitarian meltdown in Gaza, which was certainly a factor in 2014, it was not the only factor, could easily blow up into war. You know, if you back Hamas completely into a corner, then, you know, they... And there is no... You know, there is nothing on the horizon that lifts hope socially and economically, and therefore to make them even remotely popular, then that's a course of action. But also, you know, I always worry a bit that, you know, Netanyahu, I mean, this may be very cynical, but, you know, in the run-up to Operation Cast Lead, where, by the way, in my view, and I try and document this in the book, the war could have been stopped if the blockade had been at least eased, and certainly if it had been lifted, and I think that was a very important point. But, you know, Olmert was in a lot of political trouble. Netanyahu is in a lot of political trouble now. Although Netanyahu is, you know, in some ways relatively risk-averse, he wasn't risk-averse in 2014, and you sort of wonder whether that could possibly trigger something. Then there is the fact that Israel is obviously making big strides on, but they haven't by any means completed the job of putting a barrier up against these military tunnels that Hamas has been building under the Gaza border. And you do sometimes wonder, with all these circumstances, whether Hamas might think, you know, we may as well do something while the tunnels are still there. I mean, I actually believe the tunnels are a defensive mechanism, but, you know, it's undoubtedly, I mean, it's true when the Israelis say it's a military asset for Hamas, and that asset isn't going to last forever. And the Fatah Hamas talks are not going well, and all of that. So I think it'd be a very brave person who would say, I don't think there's going to be a war. I'm pretty sure, though, that most of the civilian population do not look to that prospect with anything but a great deal of gloom and fear. But, yeah, it could happen.
Thank you. Questions, please. So I would highly recommend the books. The people must have some questions. Yes, please, gentleman here.
You're talking about the two-state, one-state solution. I mean, there is a feeling, I mean, Norbert Finkelstein has been saying, that mood is changing in the United States. Young people who remember this, they are from the Zionist project, you see, they're coming out. Some of them realize that whether it is possible that this would happen. But one thing that I was very impressed when I saw the account of Max Blumenthal, you see, when he was, it was so graphic, you see, described the situation. And there is this Israeli lobby org, you see, that every year they hold a conference about it. And some of the Haaretz, the people come down, and they said that the Israelis have no idea. Just few miles away, the condition of Palestinians, you see. So I wonder whether the any likely that the Israeli lobby can come out, you see, can be changed, or it may happen, I don't know. What's your
opinion? Prospect you see for that, Don? And I think the gentleman's question is, could the Israeli lobby actually change its views and
Well, I mean, I think it depends to some extent what you mean by the Israeli lobby. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, by the way, this is a whole other question which you're not asking about. I mean, I think American Jewish opinion is a little more volatile than it used to be. I mean, I think there are even people in AIPAC, actually, who are beginning to feel quite uncomfortable with the direction of policy that Netanyahu's taking. But you're right, and in fact, when you said the difference in conditions, I was just thinking about James's reference to the donkey market. You know, it was, I remember at that donkey market I went to, it was just at a time when fuel prices had gotten shot up, and you know, you could practically see the Mitsubishis, you know, running up the, you know, that year's new cars, and the road just across the border from Shitaia. And you know, a guy said to me, you know, we're going back to the Turks, the donkey market, because everybody was trading in their cars and buying donkeys.
And the price of donkeys was going up.
And the price of donkeys was going up. Anyway, sorry, that's a bit of a digression. I mean, I do, all I can really say about that is that I think the relative absence of Gaza, and to some extent the entire conflict, from sort of public attention is, you know, works against this. But I also think that the Israeli public, you know, as you, I mean, you've hit on something there. The Israeli public have very little sense now, particularly of Gaza. I mean, the West Bank is covered on Israeli TV, but on the terrestrial channels. But Gaza really isn't. Now, there used to be, I mean, Amira Hass and Gideon Levy notably, but not just Amira Hass and Gideon Levy, actually. Journalists used to go in and out of Gaza all the time. And you know, it was a less strange place. And I mean, now I think Israeli intelligence has a very good understanding of conditions in Gaza, but I don't think the Israeli public does at all. Now, whether you know that's going to produce the kind of change that you're talking about, I'm not confident about, but I think it's a factor.
Another question, please. Yes, please, the gentleman back.
How would you view Britain's relations with the Israelis and Palestinians post-Brexit?
Well, it's a really good question. And one of the things that I think is going to be quite interesting is if Britain has to, you know, which it presumably will try and do, in fact, it's already said it will try and negotiate a separate deal, trade deal, with Israel, then I very, very much doubt, I mean, I can't say what Jeremy Corbyn would do or wouldn't do, but I think it's going to be extremely difficult to build into such a trade deal even the minimal restrictions on trade with the settlements that the EU has managed to build. In other words, you know, there are limitations, in at least technically, goods coming from the settlements don't benefit from the kind of tariff-free arrangements that the mainstream Israeli trade does. I mean, I'm afraid that's honoured as much in the breach as it is in the observance, but at least they're there. I very much doubt that they're going to be there in a UK-only trade deal with Israel. I mean, obviously, the relations depend very, very much on you know, who's in government. I mean, Theresa May's pronouncements so far on this conflict have not. I mean, they've been, if anything, I think, you know, I mean, I think at least Cameron had some calms. He did even go to Turkey and describe Gaza as a big prison, although I think he shut up about it pretty quickly after that. Theresa May seems to want a good relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, which I think is a pity. I mean, I think she's been rather admirable on China, but I don't think on. So, you know, who knows? I just think, I mean, and also because, you know, I am a pro-European, I think the UK's ability to influence foreign policy, including in Israel-Palestine, will be greatly diminished for all the harsh things I've said about the EU once it's out of the EU.
I mean, isn't it out of the EU? And also, we've been talking this evening about the weight of history, and it's still not... the Balfour Declaration is not forgotten, or indeed the British Mandate is not forgotten by anyone. I mean, the former British ambassador to Tel Aviv, Sherard Cooper-Coles, left that account in his memoir of Ariel Sharon shouting at him, saying it isn't the mandate anymore. So you know, these things... So it doesn't really... It doesn't necessarily bode well for a sort of independent British foreign policy in the region, does it?
No.
Is anyone going to listen?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I think you're completely right. And also, actually, the Balfour celebration was a time when, you know, Britain might have thought, but the British government might have thought, but didn't, a bit more deeply about its own part in this conflict. I mean, you're absolutely right. If you go in the, you know, particularly older, but not only older Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza, if you, once they know you're British, tend to mention it. And
you must have been chastised for a mouthful. I know, yes.
I always, yes, that's
normally
true.
Normally, sometimes the second thing that people would say
yeah,
to you.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think there's a very strong, there's a strong feeling about it. In fact, just towards the end of the book, a guy in Zeytun, I have recorded this conversation in which he raises all these issues, and in quite a pertinent way, actually.
And a direct one as well.
Yes, very direct.
Right in the back corner.
I'm thinking for a moment. Sorry.
Yeah. You please, sir, and then the gentleman in front of you.
Thanks very much. The Israel lobby in this country has been able to mobilise the body politic and the mass media to focus very, very intensively on the Labour Party, which I don't support, but they focused very intensive scrutiny and given real bashings to the so-called anti-Jewish section of the Labour Party because some of them speak up for the Palestinians and against Israel. How is it that I've attended several of these meetings here? I belong to CARPU. I attend meetings at SOAS, at London University, for several years now since I've retired. And I've heard all these arguments trotted out about how we've got to appeal to people's consciences, blah, 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 blah. And the pro-Palestinian, anti-Zionist movement, if it can be called that, hasn't gone an inch further forward. And how can we doubt the reason for that when, for example, the Conservative Party, at least 80% of constituency associations of the Conservative Party in this country are wholly or largely reliant on donations from Zionist pressure groups.
I'm not sure about the figures there, sir, but I mean,
it's substantial. And I think.
Do you have a question?
Yes, the political question is, how are we going to counteract the intensive focus on anti-Zionists that the Zionist lobby is able to counterattack that, focusing particularly on the Zionist corruption of the British political system?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Zionist, what you call the Zionist corruption of the British political system. I mean, I'm bound to say that, from my sub-knowledge of British politics, I think you're exaggerating that. I mean, I think the real problem is that people are not, you know, although, I mean, decent people across the political board are not particularly at the moment engaged by that by this subject, even though I think when something like the last Gaza war is on the television screens, they are. And I think you do have to sort of slightly disaggregate this kind of, to see everything in the terms that you're saying them, frankly. I mean, first of all, a lot of, you know, critics of Israel in this country are Jewish. And I think, I mean, I'll go even further and say, I don't think this is Jeremy Corbyn at all, and I certainly don't think of it really of the heads of Momentum, given that John Lansman is currently in a huge legal battle with George Galloway, precisely, as a Jew. But I do think that there is, there are tendencies among some of Corbyn's most enthusiastic supporters, which I personally find very, very frustrating, because what it does is it undermines serious and fundamental criticism of Israeli policy, which, you know, I have and many other people have, when people turn on a woman Labour MP and use social media in a, you know, frankly, blatantly anti-Semitic way. Actually, it makes the job of criticising Israel more difficult, not less so. So I'm probably not properly answering your question, and I'd be happy to, discuss it further, but I just really wanted to get that off my chest.
Yes, just one here, please.
One perhaps could talk about the influence, corrupting influence of Gulf states on British politics, but that's a different discussion. I'm thinking for a moment of the state of Israel as it currently is, claim to legitimacy, and it seems to me to have two claims, one of which is ethno-confessional and primordialist, but the other is its claim to democratic legitimacy. It's the only democracy in the region, and so on and so forth. Were a two-state solution to become unviable, and secondly, I'm kind of convinced, you know, what you were saying earlier, for reasons of demography, Israel would have been put in a situation of existential crisis. It can't claim to be both. It could either be an ethno-confessional Jewish state, or it could be a democracy. And I was wondering, firstly, about your thoughts in general about that, and secondly, how that might relate to Gaza on the one hand and the West Bank on the other.
Well, I mean, of course you're right. And in fact, you know, you don't have to go further than the words of both Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, two Ehuds, who have both said at various times, you know, we can't, you know, if we don't make an agreement with the Palestinians, then, you know, either we are going to be, as Olmert put it, an apartheid state, or Israel is going to cease to exist in its present form. And, you know, in a way, I think the sort of Netanyahu tendency is to maintain the status quo. But, I mean, even if he wants to do that, he can't control his own right wing, I don't think. So, I mean, you know, I'm no better at gazing into this crystal ball than you are, but you're certainly right. Now there's a new thing which I think is getting more favour among Israelis than among Palestinians, which is this two nations, one homeland movement, which is talking about, you know, Israelis staying in what would then become Palestine and would be a sovereign state, but still having vote in Israeli elections. I must say, I'm not very convinced about this. I mean, like many other things, I don't see how that plays in Itamar or Hebron or wherever. So, I mean, look, you know, you've expressed the problem really well, and I don't have an answer to it. But, you know, I mean, the former head of Mossad said, what is threatening, you know, the greatest threat to Israel's existence, greatest existential threat is not Hamas, not Iran, but Israel itself. And I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. There was a question down here.
Yeah, it's a small question, and I don't expect you to have a definitive answer on this. I wonder what you thought about the cultural boycott idea and whether it's talked about there.
Well, it's very funny you should mention that, because the cultural boycott of Israel.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like Noam Chomsky, I'm not, this is an oblique answer to your question, I don't think I'm yet, at any rate, in favour of academic boycotts. And I'm not sure that I'm in favour of a cultural boycott in the sense that, I'll tell you a little story about this. Leonard Cohen comes last time in Tel Aviv a few years ago, does a farewell concert in Tel Aviv, the Ramat Gan Stadium. He gives all the money to the Parent Circle, which is this, you know, Israeli-Palestinian bereaved parents forum, and offers to go to Ramallah to do a concert and donate the proceeds to Palestinian prisoners' charity. And BDS say, you know, no, this would be a violation of the boycott, and the invitation to go to Ramallah is withdrawn. Now, I mean, I understand why that was, and it's not like I've sort of got the answer to this question, but I felt, as quite a lot of, as some Palestinians, particularly Palestinians in the parent circle, actually felt, that they weren't very comfortable with that. Now, it may be that things now have gone way beyond this, and that I am just really mouthing the sentimental coexistence realities of an earlier period. But I haven't seen much. I do not think, I mean, this I am sure about, is that I don't think people should play in Israel unless they're prepared to, you know, unless they're prepared to go to at least the West Bank as well. But I'm not sure that I'm hugely comfortable with a complete cultural boycott. But I may be wrong. I'm sort of revising my opinion on all this as things get worse and worse in relation to the Israeli government's posture. Sorry, that's a bit of a fuzzy answer.
Any more questions, please? Yes.
How do you see the future of Gaza? You have this tiny area of land, 360 square kilometres. A population, I worked there for a while, the population when I left was 1.3 million. I think in the next couple of years, they're talking about 2 million. You know, the inability to still access fishing rights, areas along the border, effectively exclusion areas with some prime agricultural land. You know, sure, we're getting to a point where, you know, just diminishing resources. How do you personally see the situation?
I think everything you said I completely agree with. And, you know, the UN says it'll be uninhabitable by 2020. The water situation is absolutely dire. The electricity situation is also completely dire, and poverty is getting greater and greater because of unemployment, and now Trump is going to withhold £65 million from UNRWA, which is sort of, to me, unbelievable. And I think, I mean, what is incredible, actually, and you obviously know Gaza well, is that, you know, the social implosion hasn't been greater already than it has. I mean, I think there are all sorts of problems, particularly in very crowded parts of Gaza, particularly in refugee camps, all kinds of social problems. But nonetheless, you know, it is incredible that it's still going. I mean, this is a pathetic answer to your question because I don't know. I think it is getting worse and worse. But, you know, one of the things we didn't discuss and frustrates me beyond belief, and it's actually slightly illustrated by the presence, 36 kilometres off the Gaza coast, of a huge natural gas facility. I mean, you know, this would, Arafat, you know, when it was first discovered, Arafat went out there on a boat and said, you know, this is the, you know, the beginning of a great new future, as he was wont to say quite often. And of course, that would switch the lights on in Gaza. I mean, if now, you know, Shell, which took over British Gas, is now trying to get rid of it because the politics make it just too difficult to do. But, I mean, this is crazy that you have, and I mean, this is only one small illustration, and I'm not going into the kind of talents of Gazan people, the sort of entrepreneurial spirit, which you know well, the level of education and so on. You've got this bloody great natural gas facility, and you've got a 2 million people a few kilometres away who've got 4 hours of electricity a day. And I mean, again, all I can really say is when people wake up to the enormity of this, then maybe something will change. But at the moment, I think the outlook is extremely gloomy.
Could I ask you, what do you think the Israelis hope is going to happen?
Well, I mean, first of all, we're talking about, you know, the Israeli government and probably a majority of the public as represented in elections who voted for this government. I don't know. I think there's a division between those people who really ideologically are committed to the notion of Israel, you know, from the river to the sea, which actually the Likud constitution, like Hamas is, in mirror image, calls for, and who really believe very strongly, for sometimes for ideological reasons, sometimes for religious reasons, which James has looked at a lot, that, you know, the whole land is theirs and never more shall be so. And those who like Netanyahu, I think, just think, all you have to do is really manage this problem. you know, and occasionally if you use enough force you can probably, and clearly that's what Trump seems to think now, that you just say no often enough and this problem will go away. And I'm afraid, I think that that's, I mean, I think it is very possible for too many Israelis, not any, I mean, I know many brave, as it were, dissident Israelis, people in, you know, Shavinshtik are breaking the silence. I think B'Tselem has actually, you know, become much sharper as an agency. I think there are a lot of people, they're rather fragmented, and the sort of old piece now left has really collapsed in Israel. But there are some very, you know, good people doing some very good things. But, you know, I think too many Israeli... I mean, I think the answer to what you say is that there's a... I mean, Naftali Bennett wants the whole land. Netanyahu just thinks, I suspect, that, you know, all he has to do is keep distracting people and this problem will go away. And if the occupation is enforced strongly enough, it can be kept at bay. And I'm afraid too many Israelis can live with that. I'm sorry, that's another bad answer, but that's...
We've got time for one more question, I think, please.
To what extent do you think of the failure of the Arab Spring contributed to the worsening of the situation in Gaza, perhaps by hardening international attitudes towards intervention and involved in the region? And second question, do you think Trump is going to be make a big difference, or will it just be gesture?
Well,
because as you mentioned, you know, Obama actually, with all the best intentions, yeah, didn't actually do very much.
Well, I think, okay, take the Trump thing first. I mean, I think you're right. Trump hasn't sort of changed the contours of the conflict by saying that Jerusalem is, you know, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But I think its capacity to provoke has been already pre-proved. And I mean, you know, just in Gaza at the moment, and there are lots of reasons for this. I mean, some of it is just plain desperation and unemployment and nothing else to do. But quite a lot of young Palestinians have started throwing themselves at the fence and some of them getting killed. That's just after Trump saying this. If Mike Pence is right that Trump really is going to move the American embassy to Jerusalem in 2019, then that will certainly create elements. And I think I don't completely accept that. I mean, I know I was critical of Obama, but I think Trump is helping to empower the Israeli right. I think it's clear that settlements are fine. There is none of even the restraint there existed under the Obama administration on that. And he is making it harder and harder for people, you know, for Palestinians. I mean, you know, this is, you know, in the end, after these things, the Palestinians are very stuck. You know, they don't do anything. And everybody goes, oh, look, you know, Trump got away with it. What's the problem? You know, or they do. And then we're back in the old complaint that they're out of control. So, I think Trump has a more negative effect than you're suggesting, even if it isn't actually changing the kind of scope of the settlement. On the Arab Spring, I think it's really... I mean, James may have an answer to this. I think it's really hard to know. I mean, clearly, the Arab Spring, you know, after Mubarak fell and Morsi was president of Egypt for a while... then clearly conditions, I mean, just on a purely practical day-to-day level, improved very significantly in Gaza because it was possible for many Palestinians to get in and out of Rafah. Now we're back to where we were in relation to Rafah, despite the promises that keep being made by the Egyptians. And actually, it's very bad. I mean, how you're asking, though, a sort of more global question, which is, do people not care about... I mean, well, if people don't care about the Palestinians anymore because the Arab Spring was a failure, it's a bit unfair because the Palestinians didn't really have an Arab Spring. I mean, they couldn't. They were, you know, against... I mean, there was a bit of activity against Hamas in Gaza on a very limited scale. But, I mean, nobody's going to throw themselves at one of the best... I mean, in terms of Israel, biggest armies in the world. So, I don't know, I need notice of that question. I'm not sure.
Donald, thank you very much. I heartily recommend the book, and I just want to conclude by looking at the briefest of extracts. One, I'm sure many of us in this room, and certainly Donald and I, know people who have taken the opportunity to leave Gaza and probably won't return, but I think one of the things you really bring to life in the book is that contradiction that people feel, those who want to leave, and you talk about those who see Gaza as a prison to escape from, but also forever home, and I think you've really brought that home in the book. So, Donald McIntyre, thank you very much.
Thank you.